Hi, Steve Morrison from CSIS. This panel on public opinion is one where we're trying to bring the discussion back to the reality of opinion in America, and we have a terrific assembly of people and some brand new data to share this afternoon as the culmination, really, of the panels we brought together. Let me quickly run through who we have here on this panel and then ask Molly Ann to present. Molly Ann Brody is the Senior Vice President and the Director of Public Opinion and Surveys at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And she's joined here also by another officer of the foundation who's a key expert on opinion survey, Liz Hamill. Thank you for being with us, Liz. They've both kindly come from Menlo Park, California, to be with us. I just want to say that Kaiser Family Foundation, since the time that Molly Ann joined in mid-90s, it's really become a powerhouse and the gold standard, really, for objective, quality, sustained tracking of opinion in America on a diverse set of issues on both domestic and increasingly on global and international matters in the United States, and some very interesting ongoing tracking partnerships with the Washington Post, NPR, and others. We enjoy and benefit from being in Washington and near to their Washington operations, Diane Rowland and Jennifer Cates and others. We enjoy the opportunity to collaborate with them and rely upon their incredible talent and expertise routinely, and we're very grateful for that. Kaiser's one of our dearest and most valued partners in Washington. So thank you, Molly Ann, for being with us. Michael Elliott is here with as the president and CEO of the One Campaign. He came to that position after following a very long and distinguished career in journalism with Time International, Newsweek, The Economist. I was delighted to see that he was actually the person who initiated the Beyerhout and Lexington columns in The Economist, which we all read, and we don't quite know the genesis, but now we do. We're very grateful, Mike, for you coming in the middle of the storm that is called the G8 Summit. Right. Bono was in Washington. Yep. In the region, and when that happens, the One Campaign storm steps into high gear, and we saw just a cavalcade of emails and drama around that. And congratulations on all of the many things that happened in the last few days around that and the One Campaign. Kevin Riley is here. He's the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Comes from a nearly 30-year career with the Cox newspapers, and has been here, I believe, 2 years here in Atlanta, and has kindly given us a lot of time last night, as well as over the course of today, to be with us and to take this experience in and meditate on that, and we'll hear more from Kevin. Sandra DeCastro Buffington. Sandra joins us from the University of Southern California. She heads up the Hollywood Health and Society Institute at the Annenberg Lear Center at USC, and has pioneered the work there looking at the influence of the entertainment media and the messaging around public health matters and the impact that has upon the American opinion climate. So we have three very interesting additional perspectives to bring in addition to the new data, the survey, the fourth since 2009 major national survey that Kaiser Family Foundation is releasing today, and Molly Ann has kindly agreed to be here today as part of that launch. Molly Ann will run us through the high points, the highlights of what's contained in this new survey, and then we'll come back to our group here and have a discussion around that. Welcome. Thank you.
See if we can find the slides. First of all, I really, really want to thank everyone for giving me an opportunity to tell you about what the American public thinks about everything that you've been talking about today. It has been such an interesting and a compelling and an informative discussion, and I think that hopefully you'll be a little bit pleasantly surprised that your fellow citizens tend to agree with all of you experts and engaged citizens on these topics. I think it'll be interesting to also show you where there's a few areas where we can help help the public along, perhaps, with your leadership. But first, I do want to thank, you know, CARE and CSIS and the World Affairs Council for having this conversation. Again, as everyone has said today, it's the kind of conversation that needs to continue to happen so that we can keep these topics on the public agenda as well as all of our own organizational agendas. So first, just to quickly run through the findings, I think it's important to recognize that the public does see a strong role for the U.S. in the world. This isn't a time where we have sort of an isolationist mentality like we've seen in other periods of our history. You see here in the dark blue, 17% think the U.S. should have a leading role, another 43% a major role. And in fact, there's lots and lots of things the public thinks that we should be involved in. And you can see here, there's a variety of topics, everything in blue. If you see blue, it means they want us to be doing it. If you see orange, then not so much. There's a lot of blue in this chart, right? And the fourth line down, improving health for people in developing countries. So the very topics that we've been so focused on today and that you're all focused on in your day-to-day life, it's right at the top of the public's agenda for the U.S. role in the world. Now, certainly, there are other priorities, security issues, fighting terrorism. There are other things on people's minds, but really health is right up there. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of foreign aid, and I'm sure through all of your experiences you have heard in the past that foreign aid is not exactly the most popular among topics for the American public, but I want to unpack that a little bit. And I want to start here. This is a slide that really talks, it shows a little bit about what Senator Isaacson said earlier this morning about diminishing resources. And in a time in this country where we're talking so much about the federal budget deficit, I think it's interesting to show what people are willing to see cut back. And the bottom line answer is almost nothing. So, you know, definitely fix that deficit, but please don't touch any of my programs or any of the things that I think are important. And you can see that by anything in orange is don't touch. And anything in blue is, oh, go ahead and touch. And you can see down at the bottom there, don't you dare touch Medicare. Don't you dare touch Social Security, public education, all sorts of very popular and very important domestic programs. But at the top, you see foreign aid is an area with a lot of blue. It's a lot of blue because people are willing to see that cut back. But let's really get a better sense of what it is that they're saying there. The first thing that you need to always keep in mind when you hear talk about how unpopular foreign aid is that they don't really understand the nature and the size of our efforts. So on the your left-hand side, the pie, you can see the little orange sliver is the share of the actual U.S. budget that goes towards foreign aid activities. That's the 1%. On the right-hand side is Americans' best guess of what share of the U.S. budget goes to foreign aid. You can see that on average, they think 27% of the U.S. budget. Now, in fact, if I took every federal dollar that we spend on Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the national debt, then I'd come up with 27%. So clearly, there's a major misconception here. On the other hand, when we ask people in their own words, what do they think foreign aid spending is on? What do we mean when we say foreign aid? And people tell us what's on their mind. They do give examples that are very consistent with many of the activities. Helping with food, doing some military and defense, healthcare, government diplomacy, clothing, food, shelter, basic needs. These are things people think we are spending the money on. Given the fact that they so overestimate the share of the budget that goes to foreign aid, I don't think it's surprising that we see that over half tell us that they think the U.S. spends too much on this area. That's the blue line at the top. Much smaller shares say we're spending the right amount or spending too little. But again, it's important to think about this in context. So this is a very important point, and it's one of, I hope, your big take-home messages from the public. And that's that, well, on the left, you once again see that half that think we spend too much on foreign aid. As soon as we instead tell them that foreign aid is actually just 1% of the federal budget deficit, we see how much opinion changes. So now only 24% think we spend too much, and 66% think we spend either too little or the right amount. So I think this is an important message. A little bit of information goes a long way to affecting opinion. Secondly, when we talk about things in much more specificity, we get a lot more support for spending. So again, on the left, you see our 54% who think we spend too much on foreign aid. But on your right, if instead we ask about improving health for people in developing countries, all of a sudden too much falls to 21, and too little in the amount, about the right amount, goes up to 2/3. So what you see is actually really robust interest in spending on the topics that we've been talking about today. And a sense that even with a little bit of information, we can influence those opinions. Now, it's important to talk a little bit more about this issue now of global health spending. I think one of the main and interesting findings from our perspective, Steve mentioned that we do an awful lot of tracking, and I track what we touched on early today called the Affordable Care Act on a monthly basis. And let me just tell you, there's a little bit of a partisan divide in our country on that issue. But when you look at something like the issue of spending for global health, we don't see the same partisan divides. This is an area where there's a lot more agreement. People who define themselves as Democrats and independents and Republicans all agree that spending on global health issues is important. And not only that, but there's an awful lot of issues within global health that generate great deals of support. So again, anything in blue is something people think is a priority. And if it's in dark blue, it's a top priority. And I think you should all be very pleased to see that at the very top of that list is improving access to clean water. It is the thing that generated the most support and the highest level of top priority among a long list of very compelling issues. But the point, the other take-home point of this chart is that Americans really do recognize the needs in the world, and they see them as priorities for government spending. Now, we've started with the sense that there is some robust support for spending and that they do recognize a great variety of needs, you know, particularly the issues of children's health and clean water and some of the other topics that we've talked about today. But it is important to think of some caveats to this, too, especially when you're trying to talk about getting the public more engaged in this topic. So the first thing is shown here, and you really just can't step away from the fact that we've been in one of the most challenging economic times of our country's history, and that people are still feeling that in their pockets, in their families, around their homes. And this sense that the nation and the economic challenges still presents a challenge here you see 2/3 saying we shouldn't be spending more because of our problems at home. The second thing that I think presents a real challenge to getting the public more engaged and more active in this area is a sense that spending might not necessarily make a difference. And I think that this chart is incredibly important, and when you look at the consistency of results over the 4-year time frame, you can see that about half the public thinks that spending more can lead to meaningful progress, and about half says that spending more will not lead to meaningful progress. So clearly, I don't think the public has heard the moving litany rendition of success stories that I have heard sitting in this room today. So that's clearly one piece of information that we really need to focus on making sure that people understand. And I think it's really hampered, and one of the reasons people don't believe money makes a difference is because they are so skeptical about how much of every dollar actually reaches people in need. So if you look here on the left, you can see that the American public, on average, tells us that just 23 cents of every dollar reaches people on the ground. And on the right, they on average believe that 47 cents of every dollar is lost through corruption. And these are areas of perhaps misperception, in some cases perception, but these are the areas that I think that we can target to help change opinion and help people understand, especially when you listen to all the great efforts of everybody who's been up here around the room today. And this is why these kinds of messages and information are so important. We did an analysis. I had shown you earlier that just with a simple wording change where we just tell people that foreign aid is 1% of the budget, I can shift opinion on foreign aid spending quite dramatically, right? Well, here we did analysis where we were looking at whether this is true when you talk about support for spending on global health. And I think what's very important here are the two factors that I've circled. And that's that for those people who know, who are sort of better informed and know the actual share of the budget that is spent in foreign aid, and for those who actually believe that spending more money will make a difference, those groups are much more likely to support increases in spending. So this, again, this idea of information and an accurate, authentic understanding of what's really happening on the ground actually translates to support. The other thing I think you should just take away from this chart is this age effect, as we call it. You can see there that young people are much more supportive of spending on global on global health than older people. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later, but it bodes well for the future of this issue and for the future of addressing these problems. Now this, I have to say, I was incredibly impressed today as I listened to everybody, how many times the idea of, you know what, it's just the right thing to do. I mean, I think if we went back and read the transcript, we could probably context code that line. It'd be about, you know, one in every 10 sentences, well, no, we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And the I think what's important to recognize is that's exactly why the public thinks we should be doing it. So we have in the survey lots of reasons why it's important to work on these issues, and certainly there's security reasons, and they understand that, and there's reasons of protecting U.S. health because we don't want to bring infections into the country. There's all, yep, they get it. But at the bottom line, what always comes out and has been consistently messaged from the public is that we should be doing these things for the moral reasons. Americans are nice, they're generous, they want to do the right thing, and in this area, you have the moral argument on your side. Now, I just want to touch on a couple other findings from the survey that are reflective of some things in the Atlanta Declaration, including the idea that of working in partnership or with multilateral organizations. You can see that this is very appealing to Americans. Two-thirds believe that that is the proper way U.S. should work on these kind of topics in concert with other countries, with other organizations. And in fact, you can see here that there's strong support for giving through international organizations like the Global Fund, like the UN, like the WHO. I do think it's important to recognize, though, back to, I think, reflecting their skepticism and their concern about corruption and their concern about whether dollars actually reach people on the ground, that on the other hand, they're not so interested in seeing spending going, being directed through developing countries on their own. And so that is certainly an area where leadership is going to be needed to help convince Americans that that is a way that aid should be delivered. Now, I do think that one of the motivators for the public in terms of supporting the multilateral efforts is the sense that the U.S. is already doing its fair share, certainly in comparison to other countries. But I do think that people also recognize that the key role that the U.S. plays. So 6 in 10 say that if the U.S. were to decrease spending on foreign assistance, there would be bad outcomes. There would be more illness. There would be more death. So they do recognize the important role that the aid is in, the dollars are doing today. On the other hand, they are very skeptical that other wealthy nations would step in to fill the gap if we stepped away from our current commitments. So again, I think Americans feel like it's the right thing, the morally right thing to do, and they recognize that we're making a difference and that there's an important role for U.S. To play in the global health community. Now, I do want to wrap up just by putting this broad topic into context with what's going to be on the public's mind as we move into the election. And it's just hard to imagine that with the presidential election coming, and certainly with the economy still in its sputtering form that it is, that there's going to be any chance of getting foreign affairs or global health at the very top of a public's agenda. You can see here when we ask people in their, tell us in their own words what they wanted to hear the presidential candidates talk about, they want to hear about the economy, they want to hear about jobs. They're surprisingly still interested in healthcare. I would think they would have had enough of that by now, but they haven't. They still want to hear about the healthcare reform debate. But you can see that the issues that we're talking a lot about today are at the bottom of the list. And also, I think a disturbing trend is a decline that we've measured in the visibility of global health efforts since 2010. So if you note here, the share who say they've seen or heard a lot about U.S. efforts to improve health in developing countries, that's fallen from 57% down to 45%. Similarly, in a different question we asked, about the news media coverage, and now we're finding that about half say the news media is spending too little time covering global health, and that's up from 41% who said the same in 2010. So there's certainly an appetite out there, and one that may not be getting met. I also think it's just important to keep in mind that there's a tremendous audience of folks who are currently not engaged in this topic. So on the left pie, you see that only about 1 in 5 say they pay a lot of attention to the issue of global health, and that has fallen over time as well. And on the far right, you see it's just 12% who say that they've personally volunteered for an organization. And so there's certainly audiences here that can be engaged to be moved on these topics that we know that they feel strongly about when they're talked to. I just want to leave us with what I think the survey really does present in terms of the challenges and the opportunities in terms of engaging the public. Certainly the misperceptions about foreign aid are just consistent, persistent, and quite problematic. There's division on whether more spending is going to make any difference, and a lot of skepticism about corruption. And the declining visibility and a competing attention for the public's in an election year, I think, really does create a challenge for these issues. But on the other hand, we saw basic support for current levels of spending. We saw that that's true on a bipartisan basis. And we see so many areas in this data where the public completely aligns with the issues that are of such great importance and that are so eloquently put in the Atlanta Declaration. You've seen that you can counter misperceptions and convince the public about successes. You might be able to move the needle on public opinion. And I think it's also important to remember, and somebody mentioned today, the interest in global health among the college students and the graduate students, that I really feel like this is an area that with the energy and enthusiasm of our youth has a tremendous, tremendous future as one that can actually generate a lot more attention and concern. So with that.
Thank you very much, Molly Ann. That was terrific. We are in a very busy electoral cycle. We're also in a cycle where there's a lot of things unfolding in our country and elsewhere on health. We just had the Food Security Initiative and the G8. We have the Child Survival Summit mid-June. We have the Family Planning Summit in London in July. And we have the AIDS 2012 conference, third week of July, the returning to the U.S. soil after 22 years, 25. So we're going to have actually an unusual calendar of events that are going to draw public attention looking forward in this next couple of months. It's going to be very interesting to see how that all plays through. Sandra, do you want to say a few words about how, from your outlook, the work you do, how what Molly Ann has presented, how does that look? What's your reaction? What additional thoughts do you have?
Well, first of all, congratulations. It's a wonderful study, and it definitely informs our work. I work with Hollywood scriptwriters and producers to connect them to stories of real people around health, and also case studies from the literature. And our aim is to increase the accuracy and frequency of TV health storylines. We also work with movies and digital media. But there are a lot of findings that I think dovetail nicely. One thing you're saying is we need to get these stories kind of front and center and top of mind. And that young people are very receptive already, and maybe older people need more stories about them so they'll be more receptive. We had over 380 health storylines air on television in the last 2 years. So we're getting a lot of accurate health stories out there. And we know that from HealthStyle's research data that 2/3 of regular viewers of TV, regular viewers are defined as people who watch TV twice a week. You know, who doesn't? So 2/3 of regular viewers of TV report learning something new about a disease or how to prevent it from TV shows. And 1/3 of those viewers take action on what they've learned. So storytelling is a very powerful way to convey successes in global health and in water. So I think that's one thing. Last May, I took a group of writers and producers from Hollywood to India and to South Africa to give them direct experience on the ground of the very issues we've talked about all day, global health and water. And it was amazing to see, you know, they're very much like the people you surveyed. Few of them had been to developing countries. They knew very little about these issues. But after spending 1 week on the ground, they were absolutely convinced that this was something they needed to be involved in. And they're already writing stories. I don't know if anybody is following the new TV show Touch on Fox. It's a story about the interconnectedness or interconnectivity of people around the world. And there's a whole series of storylines from South Africa that were inspired by our visit. So I guess, you know, so that you can move on to our co-panelists here, while we're all trying to reach the public, I'm trying to reach Hollywood because they have the biggest megaphone. And I'm going to say one more piece here about storytelling. Why are stories so powerful? In the literature, there's something we call transportation. So when we're engaged in a story, and so this is a measure of engrossment in a story, we forget what time it is, we lose track of our surroundings, we come to see the characters as beloved family or friends, we care deeply what happens to these characters, and we often don't want the story to end. And in that state of transportation, we have much higher knowledge gains and much higher attitude shifts and changes in behavior. So storytelling isn't just a cute idea or kind of, you know, creative idea. It is, and later I can tell you about some comparative studies we've done, it is much more powerful than talking at people.
Good. Thank you. Mike.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you at CSIS and CARE and the Atlanta Council for putting together an absolutely incredible day and for inviting us all down here. And thank you, Atlanta. I mean, I have to say, every time I come here, I'm just sort of knocked out by this living sense of partnership that you've managed to do for so many years between the NGOs, the wonderful medical institutions, the universities, and of course, some of your leading corporate citizens. It really is an inspiring way to spend a few hours. So when I read Marlianne's absolutely fabulous report, thank you so much for doing it, we got an advanced copy and I thought, oh my God, you know, everyone's gonna think that I'm gonna be really depressed because the mean answer on how much we spend on foreign aid is 27 cents on the dollar and so on and so forth. But you know, it's a beautiful spring day in Atlanta, so I'm absolutely determined to be optimistic about this. And you know, when I started off on one of my many previous careers many years ago as a political writer in the UK, a politician I knew said to me, he said, let me give you some advice, he said. Think of a football game. Okay, soccer for you guys, all right? He said, think of a football game. He said, those of us who are in politics, you, me, you know, we're on the pitch. We're involved in every tackle, every shot. We're kind of really, really involved. He said, most people are just kind of occasional spectators, you know, they're kind of worrying about whether the green fly have got their roses, they're kind of popping off for a hot dog. I mean, they're not paying that much attention the whole time. It doesn't surprise me, actually. I probably shouldn't say this publicly, but it doesn't surprise me that people have such way off senses of how much we spend on foreign assistance. I know it's less than 1% because that's my job. You know, but if someone said to me, well, how much does state and federal government spend on education, I'd have to kind of sit and think, and I'd probably get it wrong by a substantial factor. So the fact that people do get this wrong doesn't actually bother me all that much. You know, people have lots and lots of other things to do with our lives other than kind of understand every kind of detail of the federal budget. So I'm relatively relaxed about that, particularly because Molly-Ann's key finding is that if you actually educate people and show people what's happening, they understand it very well. So three very, very quick points of optimism from the survey. First of all, the point that Molly-Ann made, the youth point, the fact that as you kind of drill down into the numbers of this survey, you see much, much more support for global health programs among young people than as you go up the age scale. And, you know, the easy thing to say is, well, you know, kids are idealistic. You know, that's what you're young for, to be idealistic. That's the point of being young. But I actually think there's something significantly bigger than that going on. This is the most globalized generation of Americans there has ever been. You know, we've now had 40 years plus since the 1965 Immigration Reform Act of pretty continuous, very, very high levels of immigration, following on, incidentally, never forget this, a 40-year period between 1925 and 1965 when there was almost no immigration into the United States. So we've had 40 years of kind of very, very significant immigration, not just from Europe, as it was from 1870 to 1920, but increasingly from all over the world, from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia. And as a consequence, my daughters, 21 and 23, who are themselves international, grew up here, born here, but, you know, have lived all over the world, my daughters and their friends have uncles and cousins and aunts who are all over the world. Their understanding of the world dwarfs those of those who are in their 50s and 60s, and they have a connectedness, a real emotional and personal and intellectual connectedness with the rest of the world, which I don't think most American politicians have yet got hold of, frankly. So I don't think it is just that they're idealistic. Secondly, the point's already been made. What's the best reason for us as advocates to go out and make the case for global health programs? You know, when Tom Frieden said, because, you know, of course, jobs are important, security is important, but you know what? It's the right thing to do. I mean, if I hadn't been terrified of kind of disturbing your southern decorum, I would have been up on my feet cheering, you know? And the fact that the poll reinforces that message, that Americans are a good and a generous people, you know, I can say that as a kind of long-term immigrant, and that they support this stuff because it's the right thing to do, I think that's a real, really strong signal to those of us who are advocates. Thirdly, very, very quickly, plainly, water and sanitation is a real hot-button issue. We know it ourselves. In the polling that we do at the One Campaign, it's something that our members always put very, very high as something they would like us to take issue on. It's actually not one of our priorities in terms of advocacy. There are many other wonderful groups who do stuff on that. We can't do everything. I'm passionate about it. I made a film on the significance of water, long series of films for the BBC more than 20 years ago. I think I'm still the only magazine ever editor who's ever put diarrhea on the cover of a news magazine. I'm incredibly proud of it, actually. It was a consequence of a bet that I had with Martin Sorrell, the chairman of WPP at a session at Davos once. We were talking about global health, and I said, I've always wanted to put diarrhea on the cover of Time magazine. And he said, you never will. And I said, God damn it, I will. And I did. But, and it's an important but on water and sanitation. As we learned from the panel just before lunch, terrific panel, it's a really complicated topic. You know, it has cultural dimensions, it has sociological dimensions, it has many different sorts of medical and scientific dimensions. It's truly a kind of multivariate issue. And that means that it is very difficult to translate into magic bullet government policy. So despite the fact that there is this enormous popular support, in my view, rightly, for water and sanitation problems, for us as advocates, it's quite tricky. I mean, are you talking about clean toilets? Are you talking about water purification? Are you talking about changing cultural norms in African and Asian countries? It's a difficult question to handle. I wish we could find a way of translating the enormous popular support for water and sanitation issues into something where we could really kind of press policy buttons and get policy changed.
Thank you, Mike. Kevin?
Well, let me make an obvious point to start as the only one here who's not an advocate. And I pointed out to Michael moments before it came up, I'm the only member of the media up here. So all those misperceptions and Molly Ann's research, I'm almost personally responsible for. And, you know, I do work in a place that is where the rubber meets the road with the public, a regional newspaper. But in maybe a feeble attempt to defend myself and distract you from attacking the media, Greg Allgood from Procter & Gamble made a point earlier about P&G's terrific couponing program. I'll just note that all those coupons were distributed in Sunday newspapers around the country, and more people read a Sunday newspaper than watch the Super Bowl on that same Sunday. So I would just point that out. But, you know, coming back around to the idea of these attitudes and these perceptions and the role that the media plays and where the opportunities are to change attitudes, we do research in our newsroom almost monthly about what topics our readers care most about. And if I had taken Molly's slide and put that up in our newsroom about the issues people are focused on in this presidential election, people would have thought it was the same research. Because those are the very topics our readers tell us they care most about and they expect us to write about and they expect us to cover and expect us to treat in a fair, unbiased way. And so the opportunity to create a greater awareness on global health and water and spending and all the issues that come to bear, I think it's important to keep those things in mind. When is the moment to make the point? When is the opportunity to make the point? And certainly, I don't think that American media, you know, certainly at its front lines in the world where I work, is somehow organized enough to conspire against your message. Believe me, if you visited our newsroom, you would not believe conspiracy was possible. but I do think it's important to accept the realities of American media and how it really works and what the expectations of the different audience is depending on the geographic location, the type of media, and some other factors, and look for the opportunities. And the opportunities are the stories. You can't find someone who works in media who's not looking for a terrific story every day. And that is the opportunity. If you can provide them, you can change these attitudes, you can help people understand. And the more people understand, the better decisions we make as a community, a nation, a world.
Thank you. Thank you very much. A few comments on the discussion. You know, in the mid-80s and in the mid-90s, we had a change politically and we had economic stress and our foreign aid budgets were slashed in those periods. And what's remarkable about listening to Molly's survey is that we're 4 years into a very stressful economic period and one of worsening polarization politically, and yet it seems that there is a resilience and durability of popular interest and support despite that and despite the continuation of ignorance or confusion around the real numbers. And I think this is, I agree with Mike that the public, people can have contradictory ideas in their heads at the same time. They can be woefully confused, but they can still come back and have an innate sense of positive feeling across political divides. And so I do think something has changed as against earlier periods where when you had stress politically and economically, it translated into a much more powerful setback for foreign assistance than what we've seen. We've seen a certain exceptionalism. How far that exceptionalism extends is, of course, a great question and one that we should think about. If we hit another very turbulent period in terms of budgets and deficits and bipartisan confrontation around those issues at the end of this year and into next year, then the question becomes, are we sitting around next year having this conversation and saying, gee, it really is quite remarkable, or do we see something different? It seems from what you've described, Molly, that the public is kind of settled into a middle ground. They're reasonably convinced of the value of continuing with the current programs. They're not calling for retrenchment. There's a nagging fear of corruption, but they're not running and saying that they think that there's gross corruption. They think that there's value here. But they also are pragmatists, and they're saying, don't do not the time or place to do a radical steep step up or a radical cutback. There's this settling into a kind of middle ground position that seems very pragmatic and affirmative, really, around the value of all of this. It's also very interesting that the age factor, the age dimension is such a cutting differentiation, and that international organizations have risen up as something that people see more value in this period, when you might have expected something a little different than that. Molly Ann, you've heard what we've just all said here. Tell us what your thoughts are.
Well, I think that it's just really important to, in a sense, keep all these things in your mind when you're thinking about talking to these audiences, in that the public is really busy just trying to keep food on their table and get their kids' homework done and try to make it through their day and their job. And they can't focus on all the details that we all do. And, you know, I also don't think I know what share of the federal budget goes to education. So, you know, I get all that. And I do think that their concerns are the economy. They are jobs. But they are nice people. They want people to have health care, they want people to have clean water, they want people to have absence of disease. And I think we've seen over and over again, certainly it comes at times of horrible natural disasters that the American public can just rally and really try to address that. But I think that we can generate that same level of enthusiasm to some of these other solutions if they get told these powerful stories and really shown that the solutions make a difference.
Mike?
Steve, I would like to think, I mean, this may be a bit of a stretch, but I would like to think that one of the reasons that, you know, knocking on every piece of wood I can find that does seem to remain significant support in Washington and around the country for maintaining these programs. I'd like to think that part of the reason for that, and we can't say this enough, talking about stories, we can't say this enough. The last 10 years have been incredible, have been absolutely incredible. You know, Mark Dybul, who ran brilliantly PEPFAR for President Bush, always likes to say that if you go back 10 years, you put a kind of collection of global health people around a table, Helene and others, you know, they would have told you that HIV/AIDS or they may not have told you because they knew better, but you know, lots of people like them would have said HIV/AIDS was this unstoppable pandemic that was going to roll around the developed world, the developing world, and then the developed world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that malaria couldn't be stopped, that there was no point in trying to distribute antiretrovirals to African villages because they were too difficult to take, and so on and so forth. Now we can sit here in 2012 and say, by 2015, we should really be able to get to a position where there is no mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and where we can look forward to an HIV/AIDS-free generation. This is amazing. Mm-hmm. This is incredible. Exactly the same story that can be told in terms of malaria and other transmissible tropical diseases. And, you know, in the next 10 years, let's roll all that out to NTDs, too. This is an astonishing story. An amazing story, what's been done through American leadership over the last 10 years. And I hope, and I guess a little bit of me, you know, believes that part of the reason that there is a sustained support, even in hard times, for these programs is because people do realize that amazing things have been done.
Thank you, Sandra.
So I'd like to give an example of the power of one storyline on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. And this was a storyline called Selfish, and it was about vaccine, the measles vaccine. And it's the story of two young mothers. One is designated the irresponsible mother. She dropped out of school. She runs off at night and leaves her daughter with the parents. She disappears. And her little girl, who's 12 months old, turns up dead. And everyone assumes, the law enforcement assume, that the mother was the cause of the death. Well, there's another mother in the story who's designated the responsible mother. She's well-educated. She has a 5-year-old son. Well, she decided not to vaccinate her son. And as it turns out, the little girl had died, contracted measles, the virus, from the boy who was not vaccinated. So there is a courtroom scene where the, in quotes, responsible mother with the 5-year-old is on trial for having murdered this young baby because she chose not to vaccinate. And so it brings up this question of, does the individual have the right to decide not to vaccinate the child without thought for how that might impact an entire community? And we did a pretest a week before the story aired to measure knowledge, attitudes, and behavior around vaccines. And then we did a post-test within a week after the story aired. So what happened? There was a significant increase in the belief the vaccine science is accurate. There was a significant increase in the belief that all parents should vaccinate their children. And there was a significant decrease in negative attitudes towards vaccines. Now, this is one shot, seeing an episode once. Now, these episodes on SVU reach about 11, 12 million viewers in the first hour. They're repeated 4 times in the first month. Then they go to syndicated rerun in over 100 countries around the world. This is one storyline. So if we're talking about reaching the public, well, we can speculate on why people believe what they believe. Well, we have the survey data. We know what they're saying to us. So I think the challenge to us is, how do we reach people? How do we give them that bit of information? And I'm going to go on one more story. And this was a collaboration between the Kaiser Family Foundation and Hollywood Health and Society. And this was a storyline on Grey's Anatomy. And it was about HIV transmission. It was mother to child transmission of HIV. And in this episode, a young couple, you know, comes to the hospital. They find out that she's pregnant, and it turns out the young woman is HIV positive. And in the storyline, the doctor says to the woman, "Your baby has greater than a 98% chance of being born healthy, that is, without the virus, if you take treatment during pregnancy and the baby's treated after birth." And the mother says, "A 98% chance?" And the doctor says, "A 98% chance." It's reported back and forth 4 times. Okay, so the research showed that at baseline, a week before the story aired, only 15% of 1,500 viewers surveyed knew the right answer. There was a greater than 90% chance of the baby being born virus-free. A week after the story aired, 61% of viewers got the answer right. At 6 weeks, there's a drop-off to 45%. It's still a 300% increase in knowledge, you know, from baseline to 6 weeks out. This is the power of storytelling. And now, with transmedia, we use television as a driver of fans, of viewers, to multiple platforms, to Facebook, to websites, and we work to put content and web links on every show that we consult on. We put web links on their shows' websites to take them to credible sources of information so that viewers aren't relying on TV shows. They get interested, they get information, their attitudes change, they get some knowledge, but these web links help them take action. It takes them to the CDC or to NCI or to another government source or to an NGO with the information they need. So I think we need to think about the power of transmedia using television, film, and new media and social media to provide the information that's lacking, and also to give young people who are already motivated and interested a way to get involved.
Thank you. One quick comment on that, and then I want to come back to something Mike said. in the last 2 weeks, there this new series on HBO, Girls, ran an episode that had very confusing messaging around HPV.
Oh, I heard about that.
And what was interesting was that it stirred this storm of debate in the editorial pages and in the professional journals and elsewhere around what were, did, you know, about was Lena Dunham ignorant, or was she trying to review or play on or portray ignorance? And what was the lasting impact going to be? And I think because of people like you, those sensitivities and the quality and standard by which people judge these messages is way up.
Yes.
So there was an immediate reaction and public debate, rather extensive and quite informed debate around what's reality, what's not reality, what's effective messaging, what's responsible messaging.
Right.
Mike, your point about the change that's happened because of this remarkable decade of investment and achievement. It reminded me of last Friday when the Secretary of State was delivering her speech late Friday afternoon, 4 p.m., on the Food Security Initiative and the G8 Summit. Senator Lindsey Graham came down from the Hill to do the introduction. Now, this was a very, very unusual political moment in Washington to have the ranking minority in the Senate on Foreign Ops Subcommittee, or a conservative Republican, come down to such an event and introduce, in glowing terms, introduce the Secretary of State and commend her, Rod Shaw, and others. And what the one thing I took away from that was, not only were all of these individuals courageous and more than willing to defy their own constituencies at times and reach across the aisle and demonstrate that they were going to do that and not worry about that, but also that this decade of investment has created a safety zone politically for people to do this. And there are very few safety zones left in our currently dysfunctional politics. And this plays to the advantage, and I think it contributes to some of what you're seeing in public opinion patterns. Kevin, can I ask you to say a few words about how this all sounds from where you sit?
Well, you know, I had a, building off the story idea, a discussion with Dr. Rosenberg this morning because, you know, I was talking to him about our list of topics that our readers want and perhaps the difficulty of getting readers interested in matters of you know, world or public health and water. And he pointed out to me, and I feel compelled to relate it to this group, is we have a huge story in Georgia that's been going on for a couple weeks now that we have written an awful lot about Amy Copeland, the young woman who, you know, got this horrible infection in just sort of a freakish accident. And, you know, I was reflecting on that, and that's what I mean about moments where something emerges and there is the opportunity to heighten awareness, increase knowledge, certainly in a very manageable way in a television show or film where that information can be so crucially portrayed in a way that pushes understanding forward. But there are events like that in the news all of the time. And, you know, I have two daughters who are college students, one just graduated, and that was the story they latched onto, you know what I mean? And they were really paying attention to. And it is fundamentally a global health story, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it fundamentally brings to the fore the kinds of issues where, you know, people here are so interested in. And I think that that's key in terms of dealing with the news media, especially on a regional and local level, when those moments present themselves, you know, making sure the right people are available to explain what's going on and to push forward the understanding and knowledge.
Thank you. I'd like to open the floor and welcome folks to come forward with quick comments and questions. Please identify yourself. Please be succinct. Yes.
Hi, Dan Rockberg from Emory University. Two questions, one narrow, one broad. First question for Molly Ann. You said if folks thought our foreign aid was 27% of the budget, they said lower it. If they thought it was 1% of the budget, they said raise it. The question is there a sort of a Goldilocks space in the middle that you found? The broader question is an observation really about reporting on successes and that it seems to be much harder to report on successes than failures or problems. The example is that I was teaching a course this year where water came up, and the issue of the UN Secretary General's announcement of achieving the Millennium Development Goal on water. I found it in a UN press release. I searched online. I think I found it on BBC Kids on like page 3 of their website. There was, you know, setting aside questions about the MBGs and whether the metrics are right, it seems like there was very little celebration of success at a global scale as related to the immense coverage of the failures or the problems. So just your thoughts on that.
Should we bundle these comments and questions and then come back? So we'll just keep track. Yes, please.
Good afternoon. I wanted to say welcome to Mr. Elliott as a proud One member. I really appreciate you being in Atlanta. And for years, I have been a faculty advisor to a One chapter on our campus at Kennesaw State University.
Fantastic.
And I think it's an excellent opportunity to teach students about global issues. My concern, however, is that there's a sense that global advocacy has become very easy. It's about clicking buttons and signing electronic petitions and making a few phone calls and writing a few letters. But I would like for us to think of ways, for One, given its vast network, to really create opportunities for students to go more in depth and to become more substantively involved in these issues. And I wondered if you had thought about that in your new role.
Ma'am?
My name is Gail Rippins. I teach international relations currently for Senior U at Mercer. I also have a marketing background. I was listening all day, and I think that the idea of clean water as relates to health needs a tagline, something like Dr. Gale said this morning, clean water is cool, or something that could be promoted. It needs to be branded, and I'm not kidding about this. People grasp a simple idea, then the brand can be repeated in the TV and all these other media platforms, newspapers that you're talking about. But for some reason, it has to grab a universal consciousness. So maybe you all can come up with a great slogan that can be used to promote this, and then there'll be a constituency to fund it.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Jamila Porter. I'm the assistant director of the Safe States Alliance, which is a national association of injury and violence prevention professionals. Wanted to thank the panel. It's been a wonderful conversation. I really wanted to thank Ms. Buffington for her comments about storytelling. I think this is a buzzword that's sort of been growing in importance in public health circles. But since we tend to be so data-driven and so data-focused, it's very difficult for us to tell the kinds of stories that resonate with the public and sort of compel people to action. And so I was wondering if you all could give us some ideas about how we could tell better stories and more personal stories. And I know there are studies that show that, for instance, giving from donors increases when they're told a personal story about who the funding would impact as opposed to just general statistics about health issues. So how can we tell more personal stories, and how can we connect those personal stories to what we know about returns on investment, about spending in global health and other issues that are important to American audiences? Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the others, folks, to hold for a moment. So we have a question around success versus failure in MDGs. We have a question from Mike about the kind of campaigning and advocacy campaigning. We have a question around branding, and we have a question around how to tell stories better. Mike, do you want to start?
Well, thank you to our friend who's the faculty advisor to the One Group. Absolutely fantastic question, something that we're thinking a lot about at One at the moment, about how our activists can be encouraged to do more than just the electronic activism, though electronic activism is important, and electronic activism is more and more important as more and more of young people use social media globally, not just in the United States, to connect with each other. So I'm very careful not to diss electronic activism, because my kids would tell me that I was very old-fashioned, but you're absolutely right that we should be encouraging people to do a lot more than that. I love the idea over here of branding water is cool or something like that, and I think you're right. I think we do need something like that.
Molly Ann?
Just two thoughts. On the spending question, we actually, and I should say this, the full report has a lot more details, and we looked at people with very good knowledge, sort of medium level knowledge, and worse knowledge, and there's definitely a relationship between that and spending. So there is a whole middle ground there, and there's a few of the full reports outside, or I'm happy to make sure you get one, or there's one online. But the other thing I'd just like to comment to the storytelling question, I really, really can't emphasize enough the importance of pointing to successes. I think that too often we're talking about the problems, and in some sense it's easy to talk about the problems, and in American politics it's very easy to talk about sort of big goals or agree on what the problems are, but it's very hard to agree on solutions to problems. And I think some of that is because there isn't a sense of what actually works. And so I think that stories around what's really working could be so powerful and so influential in the rest of this conversation as you take it more to the public domain.
If I could offer a hint on the storytelling too, I've mentioned our own research a little bit, and I don't think this is a secret, but one of the things our readers tell us they want from our stories is they want to hear about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. I think that's the guidance we give our feature writers. Yeah. I don't think that's a bad little rule of thumb, especially when you're dealing with local or regional media. Regular people doing really irregular, unusual, amazing things, that's a good selling point for a story that leads to the big understanding or the big statistics.
Sandra, you live in the art of storytelling.
We actually have done five storytelling workshops for CDC scientists. Ooh. So we work with tough crowds sometimes, but I wanted to share this statement about great stories. This comes from one of the executive producers of Grey's Anatomy, who teaches with me. Great stories communicate simple truths that reflect the dimensions of the human soul. Now that's pretty deep. So when you think about storytelling, I love what you said about really regular people overcoming great odds. So some of the keys to great storytelling, first of all, are in the details. So, you know, give a detailed setting. What's the location? Describe it in detail, as if you're standing right there. Describe it so that we can be there with you. You need a great character. So this could be the regular person, you know, who's surmounting the great odd. You need conflict. Every great story has conflict. That doesn't mean we're getting people depressed. You have a conflict, it's your challenge. Obstacle to overcome, and you have to have resolution as well. This is very simple. There's some wonderful tools, you know, we can actually post on our website that might help with storytelling. But I'm so glad to hear you asking that question. And you need to tell your story with passion. You need to care about this story. And one thing I'd encourage everybody here to do who's working in the field is collect stories. Let the people you work with tell their own stories. Have them upload them to your website. You can say, you know, do it on, you know, your iPhone or upload it to YouTube, but it can't be any more than 1 to 3 minutes, however long you want it to be. 1 minute's even better. 30 seconds it can be. And get people telling their own stories, because they may have a very different perspective than we do. And that's what we want to hear.
Thank you. I apologize to those who are still queued up. We've run out of time. I hope you'll have an opportunity to engage with our speakers after Helene has closed. Molly, congratulations to you and Liz for really a superb piece of work that really advances our knowledge. And, you know, and we're very grateful to all of you for coming considerable distances and giving us considerable amount of your time to join us on this panel today, and I think we all benefit from that. And thank you so much. This has been a terrific